You're listening to BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio, and you can also listen to us live online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news read by Ian Skelly.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, has confirmed that there will be some form of a cap on university tuition fees in England. Earlier this month, a review by Lord Brown recommended that there should be no limit on what students pay. But Mr Clegg said he was uneasy about that idea and he wanted to see something he described as more restrained. The Shadow Work and Pension Secretary, Douglas Alexander, has said he backs in principle the government's plan to replace all out-of-work benefits with a single universal credit payment. Mr Alexander called the idea sensible and admitted that Labour could have done more to reduce the number of people claiming incapacity benefit. But he said the Coalition's spending review hit the poor hardest. In Haiti, the first cases of cholera have been detected in the capital, Port-au-Prince. More than 200 people have already died in the north of the country. Aid agencies are trying to prevent the disease reaching makeshift camps, where more than 1 million people who survived January's earthquake are sheltering. Three men from the southeast of England have died in a helicopter crash in Northern Ireland. The pilot and two passengers were on their way home from a day's shooting in County Fermanagh yesterday when the helicopter came down in the Mourne Mountains. The nuclear-powered submarine, which was grounded off the Isle of Skye, is now returning to its base at Faslane. HMS Astute became stuck on a shingle bank during sea trials on Friday. The Ministry of Defence says the vessel is expected to arrive on the Clyde tomorrow when she'll be checked for damage. International experts in rock art have appealed for proper protection to be given to ancient cave paintings and stone carvings in the Sahara Desert. The experts said that unless action was taken to protect the work from vandalism and looting, an important window on human history could be lost. And the weather, there'll be plenty of sunshine in many areas this afternoon, but there'll be scattered showers in northeast Scotland and down eastern counties of England, where there'll also be a chilly breeze. And that's the BBC News and the weather. The time now is 2 minutes past one.
And it was read by Ian Skelly. Well, time now on Radio 3 to join Catherine Bott for the early music show, which today has a Neapolitan flavour.
Naples, thou heart of men which ever pantest naked beneath the lidless eye of heaven. Elysian city, which to calm enchantest the mutinous air and sea, they round thee even as sleep round love are driven. Metropolis of a ruined paradise, long lost, late won, and yet but half regained. Thank you. two movements from Alessandro Scarlatti's Sonata No. 9 in A minor, played by Dan Lauren and London Baroque. Benvenuto a Napoli. Refreshing, isn't it, to have those lines from Shelley's Ode to Naples at the top of the programme, instead of the usual old See Naples and Die. Today we're visiting, musically at any rate, a southern Italian city which is home to the purest, historically informed pizza recipes, a city with a famous street of artisan workshops making traditional presepi, or nativity scenes. Naples is a port founded by the ancient Greeks in the 8th century BC, and it's always been a fulcrum for new ideas. Over the centuries, its palaces and churches have played a vital part in the history of Italian music. Now, if someone says the music of Naples, what comes into your mind's ear today? The waspish drone of mopeds? The strumming of a mandolin? Well, pre-moped, 18th century Naples offered wonderful creative and professional opportunities not only to the man whose music began the show today, Alessandro Scarlatti, and his son Domenico, but also Francesco Durante, Giovanni Battista Pergolesi, and Nicola Antonio Porpora. And if we go a little further back in music history to the very beginning of the Baroque, there's a truly great composer whose life was as infamous as his music was revolutionary, the aristocratic Carlo Gesualdo, Prince of Venosa, Count of Conza, born in Naples in 1561. It was in his home city in 1586 that he married his cousin, Maria d'Avalos, the daughter of the Marquis of Pescara. 4 years later, he caught Maria in flagrante delicto di fragrante peccato, or red-handed in scented sin, sounds more fun in the original, with her lover, the Duke of Andria, and hacked both of them to death with the help of his servants. The scandal was immense, and Gesualdo, seemingly immune from prosecution, if not from notoriety, retired to his country estate to concentrate on composing. Meantime, he was rehabilitated. In 1593, he was allowed to make a very advantageous second marriage to another aristocratic lady, Leonora d'Este. But his lingering ill repute served only, as it still does, to draw attention to the voluptuous mannerism of his music. Here's one of his sacred works, a penitent motet with a text which may, or may not, have had special meaning for Gesualdo. Tribulationem et dolorem. I have known torment and pain, and I have called upon the Lord.
Thank you.
Gesualdo's motet Tribulationem et Dolorem, performed by the Ensemble Vocal Européen de la Chapelle Royale, directed by Philippe Herreweger. Gesualdo wrote powerfully erotic, secular madrigals, as well as sacred music. Our next Neapolitan composer, Francesco Durante, tried his hand at sacred music drama, but the bulk of his output is devotional or liturgical. He was born in 1684, seventh of 11 children of a wool comber in Frattamaggiore, in the province of Naples. Not a cultured home, but his dad was a sexton and singer at the parish church, and his uncle was a priest and musician who was the principal teacher at the Conservatory of Sant'Onofrio in Naples. Uncle Angelo spotted Francesco's talent and took him under his wing at the conservatory. Francesco Durante grew up to be an exceptional teacher of international renown. He spent most of the rest of his life in Naples, marrying three times and teaching at three different conservatories. Pergolesi, Piccini and Paisiello were among his pupils. And although true to his reputation as the greatest master of harmony of Italy, that is to say the whole world, as Rousseau eulogised him, he was always a stickler for proper harmony and counterpoint, he did let his hair down to write some music to delight courtly ears. This is the Allegro from Durante's Harpsichord Concerto in B-flat major.
Thank you.
Gerald Hambitzer was the soloist with Concerto Köln, directed by Werner Erhardt, in a movement from a harpsichord concerto by Francesco Durante, a key player in the development of 18th century Neapolitan music. Musical life in Naples wasn't all about the church, of course. You don't need me to tell you that the opera house exerted an equal hold over many musicians, especially in the years when opera was a new art form. But staying with the church for a little longer, let's turn to the Scarlatti dynasty. We heard chamber music by Alessandro, prolific pioneer of Neapolitan opera and father of ten, at the beginning of the show. The Scarlatti in the spotlight now is his sixth child, Giuseppe Domenico, born in Naples in 1685. Given the importance of his family to Neapolitan musical life, it's irksome that young Domenico's early musical life is so poorly documented. He may have been taught by Gasparini and Pasquini. He must surely have had some lessons from his father. Certainly, Scarlatti Sr. made sure his talented son made his mark on the musical map of Naples. He arranged for his appointment as organist and composer of the Chapel Royal in the city when he was just 15. After extended periods of work in Florence, Venice and Rome, Domenico eventually became Domingo Scarlatti, ending his days in Madrid. With 21st century post-Freudian hindsight, it's tempting to rationalise Domenico's widely travelled career as a conscious attempt to get away from his father's preeminence at home. Alessandro endured some traumatic experiences when he ventured north and eventually retired to Naples, where he could be a grand old man of music. Similarly, Alessandro presumably wanted only the best for his son when he ordered him to leave home. This is what he wrote about the 20-year-old Domenico when recommending him to Ferdinando de' Medici in 1705. "I have forcibly removed him from Naples, where, although there was scope for his talent, it was not the kind of talent for such a place. This son of mine is an eagle whose wings are grown. He must not remain idle in the nest, and I must not hinder his flight." Well, Domenico's wings eventually took him right out of Italy. All those Iberian-tinged keyboard sonatas are perhaps his lasting legacy. His early operas, written in Naples, are lost. So here's the next best thing: the opening of his setting of the ancient hymn Stabat Mater Dolorosa, probably written in Rome between 1715 and 1719.
Thank you.
Harry Christophers conducted the 16 in part of Domenico Scarlatti's Stabat Mater, depicting Mary's anguish at the cross. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott. I've said that details of Domenico Scarlatti's early musical education are surprisingly sketchy, given his heritage, and given that he grew up in a city famous throughout the civilised world for its musical conservatories. You may know the expression, the Neapolitan school. Well, that partly refers to these eminent conservatories and partly derives from the rigorous expertise in harmony and counterpoint shown by composers like Durante, whose concerto we heard earlier. Great claims used to be made for the originality and dominance of Neapolitan opera, too. But in general, musicologists today rather play down the uniqueness of Naples as a musical fount and origin. There is one kind of music that Naples can definitely lay unique claim to, though. Canzone Napoletana, popular solo street songs, often in Neapolitan dialect. These songs often fused Italian and Spanish characteristics. In the 16th century, the Kingdom of Naples had been a Spanish province, and they were wonderful vehicles for the solo voice. Here are two refined but zesty examples from the 17th and 18th centuries. The first is by Francesco Lambardi, born in around 1587, singer and organist at the Chapel Royal in Naples. This is Cupido Solo Dice, in which Cupid introduces himself as the ruler of all lovers, whether they like it or not.
Cardi il modo in questo loco, nel mio fuoco, cardi il modo in questo loco, nel mio fuoco. A voi sorgo e vi porgo, queste schiere e questi amanti festeggiati. Ma che donne sol sostengo, nel mio regno, ma che donne sol sostengo. Del mio regno in lo scocchi da vostro occhi sangue stralla qui ferita inanita e sannar con la voltare del mio strare e sannar con la voltare del mio strare questi amanti alla cui per fiamme ercene l'acquistar sorte e servirvi di gradirvi l'acquistar sorte e servirvi di gradirvi.
Non dorma più,
For 3 days Nina's been lying in bed. Oh, fifes, drums and cymbals, wake her up. Tre Giorni by Pergolesi, sung by Mathieu Abelli, with Jay Burnfield directing the ensemble Fuoco e Cenere, Fire and Ashes. And before that, Mathieu sang Cupido Solo Dice by Lambardi. Giovanni Battista Pergolesi has had a whole early music show to himself fairly recently, partly to sort the authentic compositional wheat from the vaguely attributed chaff, so much of which the poor man could never have had time to write, dying as he did at the age of just 26. He's called Pergolesi because his family came from the town of Pergola, but he became a Neapolitan through and through when he was sent there in 1720 as a sickly boy of 10 to study at the Conservatorio dei Poveri di Gesù Cristo. He's especially remembered today for his charming comic intermezzo La Serva Padrona and his powerfully soloistic setting of the Stabat Mater, which raises a very interesting point about crossover. In Naples, in Pergolesi's time, there was very little to separate church singers and musicians and those who worked in the theatre. Any official demarcation line had been rubbed out in 1684, when the Marquis del Carpio wanted some theatre singers to take part in Holy Week music-making in the Royal Chapel. Next, he appointed Alessandro Scarlatti as his maestro di cappella, and with Scarlatti came some of the finest bel canto singers of the day. This fed into the writing of liturgical music in Naples. A composer like Pergolesi could count on the services of a stage-wise singer to make the most devout of his works a thrillingly histrionic experience. And in this performance of his hymn to the Mother of God, who is the Queen of Heaven, we'll hear a modern-day singer who would surely have delighted Pergolesi. Andrea Scholl sings his Salve Regina.
Oh,
Pergolesi's Salve Regina, sung by Andreas Scholl, with Les Talents Lyriques, directed by Christophe Rousset. That work was written in the final weeks of Pergolesi's short life, and as we've heard, it's a glorious example of the cross-pollination of sacred and secular drama that prevailed in 18th century Naples. Now, in case you think I've been willfully avoiding the world of opera, let's turn to a quintessential figure of the stage for our next music. In the year that Pergolesi died, 1736, the Naples-born composer, teacher and impresario Nicola Antonio Porpora was returning home from London, where he'd been invited to set up an opera company to rival the one Handel was running. Although Porpora's company, the so-called Opera of the Nobility, eventually failed due to a lack of public support, the fact that his reputation had spread to London testifies to the international renown of Neapolitan opera. Opera Naples style was dominated by opera seria, noble, cathartic, lengthy. But the early 18th century saw the birth of Neapolitan comic opera, often in Neapolitan dialect. Composers were let off the lead to write simpler, more direct music with ensemble numbers as well as lofty arias. Here's an excerpt from a work that Porpora wrote or compiled during his London visit. I say compiled because it's a pasticcio, a sort of compilation opera with material from other works by several composers. From Orfeo, this is Dall'amor più sventurato, which makes the brave claim that unlucky love actually makes the heart happy, because one moment of rapture repays all the suffering. Music from a pasticcio or pastiche by Porpora, sung by Viveca Genot with the Akademie für Alte Musik Berlin, directed by René Jacobs. Porpora was born in Naples in 1686 and died there in 1768. 50 years after that, a daughter was born in the city to the English poet Shelley, and I thought we'd return to his verse to end today's programme. Shelley didn't quite see Naples and die, and he didn't coin that famous phrase either, but at the time of his visit he only had 4 years to live. The final music we'll hear is the Andantino from the Sinfonia Il Demetrio by the Neapolitan composer Leonardo Leo, who died in 1744. It's played by Ensemble Turicum. And the words are from Shelley's Stanzas Written in Dejection Near Naples. The sun is warm, the sky is clear, the waves are dancing fast and bright. Blue isles and snowy mountains wear the purple noon's transparent might. The breath of the moist earth is light around its unexpanded buds. Like many a voice of one delight, the winds, the birds, the ocean floods, the city's voice itself is soft like solitudes.
Part of the Sinfonia from Il Demetrio by the Neapolitan composer Leonardo Leo, with words from Shelley's Stanzas Written in Dejection. And that ends today's Early Music Show. It was presented by Catherine Bott and produced by Paul Stapley. And in next Saturday's programme, Lucy Skeeping will be here to explore the wealth of musical references in the diaries of Samuel Pepys, which were begun 350 years ago. That's the Early Music Show next Saturday at the same time, just after the 1 o'clock news.
His music is accessible, exuberant, teeming, hypnotic, admired by classical concertgoers, rock bands and house music DJs alike. Steve Reich, 75, next year, has altered the direction of music history. For this week's Radio 3 Composer of the Week, I visited Reich's home in upstate New York for a wry, witty and disarmingly candid interview about the ideas and influences behind his work alongside some of his music.
We just started improvising clapping patterns at each other, and the light bulb went on in my head, and I was thinking, what happens if the lights and the power goes out, the transformer doesn't work? We have to have a piece that we can just do anywhere, anytime.
Steve Reich talks to me, Donald McLeod, in Composer of the Week.
A Sunday afternoon Boston Symphony Orchestra subscription concert would really bring out the blue-haired ladies, and I don't mean the punks.
Weekdays this week at 12 noon and 10 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
Back to this Sunday afternoon. It's a little after 2 o'clock, and now here's Chichi Nwanaku with a couple of hours of your Radio 3 requests.
Thank you. I'd like to launch the programme with one of the 20th century's most evocative pieces. It is about and affects everyone, and in his own words, Gustav Holst said, how each movement encapsulates one constituent of our spirit, corresponding to that planet's astrological character. It's for Brian Oxley in South Gloucestershire, who's asked specifically for the Black Dyke Mills Band's version of Holst's The Planets. Thank you.